This is Startups for Rustvis, episode 184. Welcome to Startups for Rustvis, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Rob?
Things are good. I am in Denver for Copy Bloggers Authority Conference. It's called the Authority Intensive. You know, so this is more about copywriting, content marketing, and that kind of stuff. So I plan on knowing almost no one who's attending, which is always a good thing, right? To kind of expand the network, and then hoping to, you know, obviously meet some folks and learn more about the modern day tricks and stuff that content marketers are using. So been fun so far.
Cool.
Yeah, had a good dinner last night with several micropreneurs, MicroConf attendees, Academy members, just folks who follow the podcast. And, you know, Ruben Gomez was there, and Dave Rodenbaugh, and Rudy, and from Hireflow, which is now Square Hire, I guess, and several other folks. So it was a good time.
Oh, that's awesome.
How about you? What's going on?
I'm trying to wind down my consulting a bit. My schedule has shifted a little bit. So I said that I was originally scheduled to be done, or at least be taking a break from it for a while in September. And it looks like it will be next month instead of September. Shaved about 3 months off that schedule. Kind of looking forward to it.
Very nice. Congratulations, man.
That looks
nice. You're going to have more time than you know what to do with once that's all over.
Well, that is the plan.
Yeah, indeed.
This week, we haven't done it in a while, so we're going to go through a bunch of listener questions. They're kind of stacked up, but we're going to try and do our best to work through them. And our first one comes in from Brett, and he says, Mike and Rob, I'm a faithful listener, but having found you only about a year ago, I can't say I've listened to all of them. I was wondering if you've ever discussed online storage in detail. I'm working on a web app for the construction industry. I'm wondering about where this should ultimately be hosted. I found myself wanting to know more about services such as AWS, and I thought others might have some similar questions. If you think it's appropriate, I'd love to hear more about where you guys host your apps and the costs that you guys have. Thanks for all the free info you guys provide.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of options out here. I don't think there's any one right answer. I've always thought, and I've used shared hosting on DreamHost for years. DreamHost is not a fantastic host, but they're very inexpensive. And if you're going to be building your app for 6 months, then it's a great place to pay. I don't even, is it 10 bucks a month now? I don't know what it is, but it's very, very inexpensive. And you can host Rails there. You can host PHP. You know, it's Linux hosting, so you can do a bunch of stuff. That is where I've had an account there for 7 or 8 years. As your server gets older, they don't upgrade it, and it gets slower and slower. But especially for the first several years, it'll work really well. But I see DreamHost as a place to go, get cheap hosting, and then once you get traction with something, once you launch, then you move over to one of the more expensive providers like an AWS or a Rackspace. Now, I've heard bad things about Rackspace's cloud servers from a friend of mine, a startup founder. He said that the performance wasn't that great, so you may have to go with hosted, you know, like an actual dedicated box or something. I haven't done it. I haven't used their cloud servers. We use Amazon EC2 now, and that works great, but it's pretty freaking complicated. You know, it's not something like DreamHost. You enter a few things, boom, you have a website up. So if you're more of a beginner, that's a good place to go. Amazon is a learning curve just to learn how to provision boxes, and you get bare metal and you have to install everything. So there's a lot of time investment there, but it's certainly a good solution long term. And then what's nice about doing it with Amazon ultimately is that if you do need to store files, you have S3. If you need DNS, they have a DNS service. So they have a whole ecosystem around it. The one other place that I've heard about that's pretty up and coming is called DigitalOcean, and it's simple cloud hosting built for developers. That's their headline. And I know some folks using them. They have really cheap VPS. You can get like a $5 a month VPS through them. It's only half a gig of memory and, you know, 20 gig SSD drive, but they're scaling up really, really fast. So that'd be someone I'd keep my eye on. And for 10 bucks a month, you can get 1 gig of memory. So I haven't tried it personally. I do know a founder who's using it to great effect. So maybe, you know, if you have the experience, I'd kick it off with DigitalOcean instead of DreamHost and give it a try if you're willing to experiment with it.
Just to kind of piggyback on the things that you said about DreamHost, I use DreamHost as well. And I've also kind of encountered some of the speed issues that Rob has over the years, because they don't tend to upgrade those machines terribly often. But about a week or two ago, I got an email from them saying that they were going to be upgrading my machine. So they took my VPS and they actually moved it to another machine that has an updated hardware platform. So things seem to have gotten reasonably fast on that machine. So they do upgrade them on occasion, but Rob's definitely right. I mean, they will go for years without upgrading it, especially if nothing breaks. On the Rackspace side, what I found was that their version one cloud servers were quite a bit slower. Recently, they've started doing everything on their version two of their cloud platform, and their version two servers are all backed by SSD drives. So there's a huge difference between version one and version two. You do have the option to migrate from version one to version two, but I haven't done it yet because I have a lot of stuff on there, and there's a lot of DNS entries that I would probably have to upgrade because they are switching things from IPv4 to IPv6, and I don't know all the implications about the additional IP addresses that I've had there. So the last thing that I used is Microsoft's Azure platform. So I've got some servers out there. Initially, they seemed like they were a little slow, but I think that it's in many cases very similar to what Rob's experience with AWS is, especially when you're going towards the hosted platform for Azure, where there is a huge learning curve to be able to spin up and spin down those machines and get all of the software and everything else that you need installed on it and to be able to deploy new builds and things like that. It can be extremely complicated. So there's a huge learning curve there. If you can get away with avoiding all of that stuff, I totally would before going to that. I think that it's great for having the back end and, you know, all the different storage options and load balancing and all that kind of stuff. But I almost feel like it's overkill for, I'll say, entry level SaaS applications, because you don't necessarily need all that stuff. You can get away with just a single server at Rackspace or something like that. And you can also get just a single server as a VPS over on the Azure platform, but it's just sort of a different technology there.
Yeah, this is such a form of premature optimization, or it can be. Like, unless you have paying customers or a decent sized launch list, then I would choose cheap hosting. I would go with DreamHost, or I would take a flyer on DigitalOcean, do their $10 a month thing, and build and deploy on that until I had a reason to move off of it and bite the bullet. That means until you have enough load, or until you're having enough problems that you need to do a migration. We had to do a migration of the Drip database within the first few months because we got a bunch of customers, had a bunch of load, and we moved from we were on a Heroku Postgres instance, and we moved into EC2. And it did suck. Like, it was, I'm not going to paint a pretty picture of it, but we got it done really quickly. And I don't regret the fact that, you know, for the previous year, we weren't on this enormously expensive database server, which is what we're on now. Because A, it saved money, and B, we didn't need to get a DBA involved because the Postgres one had did all the backups and did a bunch of other stuff for us. And so at this point, it was like, well, this idea is viable. We have paying customers. And it justified me, A, getting a DBA involved and paying him to get everything set up with backups and all that kind of stuff, and B, to, you know, just to do the move and to really get a beefy server. So this is one of those things to put off as long as possible within reason. I mean, if your customers are having issues, that's the time to start making a quick move to a new server platform.
Anything where you've got a virtual machine of any kind, you always have the option to throw money at the problem and buy yourself time. And that's kind of the bottom line here, is if you can buy into a VPS at the lowest possible level, you can always throw more hardware and more money at the problem later when you do have paying customers. So thanks for the question, Brett. Our next one comes in from Joel, and he says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. My question is, how do you know when to pivot? I've been putting it off because I feel that many entrepreneurs pivot too early. My SaaS app launched 3 years ago and is making a steady income. It's a horizontal membership management tool for nonprofits, but I found that 80% of my customers are youth ministries. Targeting this market specifically might have an upside, but it's not a guarantee, and I don't want to lose the other 20%. So what's the rule on when to pivot to a specific vertical? Is it 80-20, 90-10, 60-40, or something else? Thanks, Joel."
I guess it really depends on the growth. First of all, I don't think there is a rule. I think it's got to be a gut feeling. I think that putting it off as long as possible is probably a good thing, because I also think that a lot of entrepreneurs pivot too early. With that said, if you've been flat in terms of earnings for 6 to 12 months and you've tried, you know, all the marketing approaches and the optimization, and I mean, whatever approaches you can to grow this, and it's not growing, then that's where I start thinking about not pivoting, but about either niching down, or which is what you're looking at, or niching out, right? De-niching and going to a more horizontal. Since you're already horizontal, I would consider just putting a landing page or kind of a mini marketing site together for the niche, for the youth ministry niche that you're looking at. and experiment with starting to drive traffic to that page instead of to the homepage if they're coming from the youth ministry places. Or if you already have a bunch of organic traffic and it's all going to the homepage, then switch to the homepage and then add a separate landing page for everybody else for the generic version and try to send your generic traffic there. I don't know that that's as much a pivot as just trying to position yourself, right? Trying to hit different audiences with your marketing. If it actually requires major feature revamps, that's what I would consider. That's a product pivot. You're talking more about a market pivot, right? A market or a marketing pivot. And those two are of different levels of effort because market and marketing can be changed fairly quickly, whereas product involves getting developers involved, writing new features, changing onboarding email sequences. You know, it's a whole different deal. So I would first, if it has been a while and you haven't had growth, I would first look at trying to do a market pivot, but almost splitting it, like I said, where you have multiple sites or landing pages and you can cater to multiple markets. And then only kind of worst case would I then think about, okay, am I really going to change the app in order to cater to this audience? And I would also ask, is there a way that you can find this out without going and writing code? Like, what's the quickest way to validate this assumption? You know, could you ask your existing customers? Could you ask your existing trial users? Do you have an existing email list of people who've been going through an email mini course that are just prospects? They're not even trial users. Could you try to survey those three audiences with questions that will get rid of this assumption? So you're not just guessing, but you're actually getting some data up front that can help guide this, you know, whether you make this pivot and then what kind of pivot it needs to be.
Yeah, as Rob was talking, one of the things that I thought about was there's a website that I had looked at a while back for managing membership website called Groups. It's grou.ps. And if you go to their website, it seems like if you start looking at their website and try and figure out whether or not it's applicable to you, they have like all these different landing pages all over the place that target all of these different niche markets that might want to use their product. Like they'll have specific areas and landing pages for youth ministries. They'll have one for coaches, college coaches, high school coaches. They'll have some in there for like ballets. There's just all this stuff in there that they're trying to market to all of these different things. And it seems to me like that if you're a small business, it seems like doing a lot of those all at once is probably very, very difficult to do. And I think that Rob's kind of on the right track going down and figuring out whether or not, you know, you can validate those assumptions about whether or not the, you know, specific markets are going to be more applicable or kind of a valuable area to go after, even if you ignore those other ones. I mean, can you market much more effectively the app to just youth ministries versus that other 20%? Was your message getting diluted by trying to gather that other 20% and increase that percentage? It almost feels like if you're not doing that already and you're kind of organically gathering that 80% already, it almost seems like doubling down on that would probably be the way to go. I mean, it seems like if you focus on them, you would probably attract a lot more than you already are because they may not be finding you. How are these people getting to your website? And I would start backtracking a little bit and see if maybe your marketing message is getting spread through these ministries. I mean, maybe that's where a lot of the source of your marketing efforts are coming from. It's not from you directly. It's from these people sharing the word about, you know, they go to conferences or talk to each other and say, hey, well, how do you manage your membership? How do you get people to come in a lot more? And maybe they're sharing it. So maybe have a sort of a viral component to it that other industries that might use your product might not have. So Joel, hope that helps. Thanks for the question. Our next one comes in from Stefan, and he says, hi guys, longtime listener here. I have a question for you about SaaS billing. Do you use a specialized payment provider such as Chargeify, Recurly, or Chargebee to handle recurring payments, Dunning, retry management, or do you manage all this through custom code? I'm looking to switch to one of these providers as my biggest headache right now is managing failed payments. It's turning into a real-time sink. As you know, customers do not like updating credit card details. All the best, Stefan.
So I don't use Chargeify or Recurly. In some apps, we use PayPal subscriptions, which I don't recommend. In other apps, we use Stripe. And we custom code everything because I want to be in full control of everything. I would actually recommend going to Stripe and using their subscription API. They will handle a bunch of that stuff for you. They handle the Dunning emails, the retry management, all that stuff. And it just requires, you know, there's no extra cost for that. The nice part about doing that is it's cheaper than using Chargeify, Recurly, or Chargebee because they add an extra, you know, percentage on top of a service like Stripe. In addition, once you get that going, there are some providers that are now tying into Stripe that are doing like phone calls to your customers to get them to update credit cards. So one that I know of is called Churnbuster. It's churnbuster.io. I've had a look inside that, but I can't use it. I would use it in a heartbeat, but I can't use it because with Drip and Hittail, we don't use a subscription API of Stripe. We just use the bare bones, make a charge API, and we have all the scheduling and the retry and stuff built into our code. Now, the reason we did it that way is, one, because it didn't take that much time to write. We already had it built for another app, and we were able to just move it in. And two, because there are some really fine subtleties that I wanted to be in control of in terms of upgrading and downgrading on a monthly basis based on usage. And if you have that, it does get a little more complicated because you have to keep hitting and updating subscriptions, you know, through the subscription API. But all that said, if you can, unless you have a reason not to, I would consider using that subscription API, because not only do they give you the basis for it, but then there are these other services tying into it that I think can help with the dunning emails and the retry management that you're talking about.
Yeah, the only downside to using that, which I use it for one of my apps, is that you basically have to create webhooks on your side to be able to handle those callbacks to your application to be able to perform those different actions, which is not a terribly big deal, I don't think, because you're still going to have to write code to handle a lot of this stuff anyway. Another option is to use bstunning.net, and they have basically a mechanism that hooks into that stuff for you. And again, you're probably going to have to write some code there as well. Personally, I kind of went the custom route, as you know, just like Rob said, just to kind of be in control of the entire process from beginning to end. And you know exactly what's going on. And if you have any special cases, you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to worry about working around somebody else's API. You don't have to worry about somebody else doing something that's going to break your stuff. The biggest thing that I have to worry about is whether or not Stripe is up and running and whether everything works properly. As long as they're making sure that all of their code is backward compatible with all their APIs, I really don't have to worry too much about it. If you don't have the time, then definitely use one of those other options. But I think that if you do, then investing in, you know, writing that code yourself is probably a better option. So thanks for the question, Stefan. Our next question comes from Khalil, and he says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. I'm building a startup in Saudi Arabia, which involves a centralized website to act as a portal for patients in the kingdom to create appointments with any medical provider in the region online. Currently, we're looking for an early adopter for our system, but all medical centers that we've visited so far are skeptical of having an integration with our system. What do you think we should do? How do I get enough trust from these people to have them act as an early adopter for a medical application?"
As a first-time bootstrapper, I don't know that I would go after a medical application. You know, in the US, they have HIPAA laws, which are the Health Privacy Act laws, and they are very, very strict. And it requires a lot of work. And typically, medical providers won't work with some bootstrapper, you know, like a single founder with no funding and just kind of a person off the street, so to speak. It's tough to say. I would hate to tell you to bail on this idea, but this seems like just an uphill battle. If you can't even get people to talk to you about it, how are you actually going to make sales in the long run?
It sounds to me like the value proposition doesn't overcome the trust issue. And I don't know exactly how you would overcome that trust issue. I mean, really, maybe you go after universities where they have a little bit more openness with regards to the information that they're sharing, for example. So there's any sort of clinical research or something like that going on where they're going to be publishing and sharing the results of those things, then potentially that's an avenue. But I think that going after those medical centers directly would probably be difficult just for the reasons that Rob pointed out.
Trying an alternate route first, because you're trying to attack that problem head on right now, right? You're just going into the big medical places, trying to go in there. But if you can figure out someone who maybe doesn't have the restrictions of the medical privacy, like Mike said, people are doing research, or someone who's already made it public, or just somewhere where it's a little bit of an easier in, that's what I would look to do. Because if you know, the value proposition outweighs the risk. If you've tried to validate that and you've talked to 10 facilities and they've all basically said no chance, then to me, you've kind of validated that the assumption is incorrect, right? So then the next step is, well, what do you do? I don't think it's, well, how do I build trust? How you'd build trust is you'd raise a bunch of money and build a huge product. And that, I mean, that's how you build trust, right? You say, we're backed by so-and-so. Like, what are they going to trust? What name can you have on your board, or what name can you have as an investor, or what sort certification do you need? I mean, these are the things that would build trust, but all of those things, to completely change the shift of your business, they're expensive. All of these things make it really, really hard and make it, to me, it's a non-bootstrapper friendly business at that point. And so that's what I would look is, how can you take this idea and move it into something that is not so either so heavily regulated or just so heavily not as willing to move forward with new technology like the medical field probably is.
My thought with moderate pivot there was that you could essentially leverage the university's name and say, oh, well, we're working with this university over here and they're using it. So it's good enough for them. And a lot of those universities have relationships with hospitals and medical centers in the region, because if they train doctors at the university, then those doctors need to go do their residency someplace. And you can kind of leverage their name. Now, it's not to say that you don't go after that and just stay there. I mean, that's entirely possible. It may be that it's very lucrative to stay over there, but I think that that would probably be the easiest way. But as Rob said, going head on is just probably not going to work. It seems like you've validated that that's not going to work. I think that the appropriate thing to do would be to kind of pivot a little bit and then see if that works. And if not, maybe look around and see what your other options are. So thanks for the question, Khalil. Our next question comes in from Paul. Hi, Mike and Rob. I love your podcast. I'm very happy I found you guys. Here's the issue I have. I've run an e-commerce business in the past that I started from scratch that allowed me to learn every aspect of the business, from marketing and technical to customer service and operations. It also helped me identify many gaps that are there in the e-commerce business. One of the gaps I identified was the inability for smaller merchants to obtain a discounted shipping rate from major carriers unless they ship large volumes. Also, there are only a few order management systems that allow multi-channel processing and provide shipping discounts. So about 6 months ago, I decided to build a system that will integrate with multiple sales channels such as eBay, Amazon, Magento, BigCommerce, etc., as well as shipping carriers. The system provides merchants with a simple way to print multiple shipping labels using discounted shipping rates. I was able to negotiate volume discounts with DHL and UPS, and I'm now negotiating with the United States Postal Service. I'm about halfway through development and have dropped a significant portion of my savings into it, which has put me in a slight state of anxiety. I find myself jumping around constantly, changing the scope from starting small and building a system for eBay only and DHL. The next day, I wake up and feel that customers would not be interested in only those two options, and I change the scope to eBay, Amazon, and a major shopping cart working with DHL, UPS, and FedEx. Listening to your Lean Startup episode kind of put things in perspective, and I'm more confident about the strategy now.
My first advice to Paul is, I don't think that you can go based on your gut feeling, because day to day, your gut feeling will change, especially if there's a lot of money on the line and you're stressed about it. I think you should stop writing code, and I think you should talk to people who are willing to pay you money for this. I would try to connect, if you're not already connected, with the Tropical MBA audience, with, you know, there's e-commerce podcasts, there is the Dan and Ian's DC. There's a lot of e-commerce folks in that space who are, they're nice folks. They're willing to lend an ear. And if you run an e-commerce site, you may know a few, but that would be my question, is what are they doing and what can you build for one customer or five customers who are willing to pay you money? So if they only need eBay and DHL and they're like, yes, I would pay X amount a month for that, find them and build the product for them. But if they say, no, it has to have all these things, then either decide to build all those things, which sounds like a ton of work to me, or find someone who has a little simpler use case.
You get those first couple of customers that need one of them. I mean, I can't imagine that, you know, a small retailer would have a preference for who they want to use. Do they want to use DHL or UPS or FedEx or the Postal Service? It seems to me like they would have a preference. And on their website, they're probably only offering one or two of those options. So build those options for that one customer and then expand from there. I don't think that you need to launch with all of them. You need somebody to pay you money, of course, but starting with one customer or two customers or three customers who have overlapping needs, that helps get you where you need to be. And eventually down the road, sure, you can put those other things on the roadmap, but I don't think that they need to be there on day one.
Right. And this is something that Dan Norris had talked about, who launched Informlay, where he built, I don't know, 15 integrations or something. And he said he regretted doing that, that he should have started with one, figured out if it was valuable, and then expanded from there. So I would lean towards that. I would also say, you mentioned the value proposition. There's these two sentences. You say, one of the gaps that I identified was inability for smaller merchants to obtain discounted shipping rates unless they have large volume. So that's one value prop. Then you say, also, there are only a few order management systems that allow multi-channel processing and provide shipping discounts. So we have discounts and we have multi-channel processing. Which of those is most important? Which one is the wake up in the middle of the night? What are the e-commerce people really want? Do they want discounts or do they want multi-channel? Because my guess is it's not both. And if you dump one of those, you make this a lot simpler. Because if you dump the multi-channel, and you just go after discounts, then I would just start with one provider, right? But if you find out that no, these guys really want multi-channel and discounts would be nice, obviously discounts are always nice, right? But the multi-channel is super important, then your revenue model comes into place, because if the discounts aren't as important, then you can take a cut or you have some play there. But trying to offer both discounts and multi-channel, my guess is there's a reason that hasn't been done already, either dealing with complexity or price. So I think you kind of want to nail down that single value prop at this early stage as a bootstrapper. You can't serve too many masters with your product.
Yeah, it seems like the going overboard on simplifying it would probably be appropriate, because if you get rid of the multi-channel and just focus on the discounts, it makes your marketing proposition a lot easier too, because you can say, hey, if you sign up for this service, we'll be able to get you volume discounts and we'll be able to save you X dollars a month on your shipping if based on whatever percentages, and we're only going to charge this much to you. So it's a no-brainer at that point. It makes selling people very, very easy at that point.
Right. Get big company discounts, even if you're low volume, right? I mean, that's kind of the headline that I would start with, if that's truly the value prop.
So the second point was, I wanted to get your opinion about my business model. Most of the competitors out there are all based on monthly premiums ranging from $50 to $150 monthly. I thought that I would not be charging my customers anything but take a small cut of the shipping labels that they print. Being that I'm providing a discounted rate, I thought I would charge a small percentage of the label cost without the customer ever feeling the impact. I think this is a bad idea. And the reason is because you almost get into the situation where you're going to end up with a lot of people signing up because they want to check it out because they're not paying a monthly fee. And whether they use it or not is almost immaterial to them, because if they only pay for it when they use it, then if they're going to use it a lot, then great. But you may very well end up attracting a lot of the people who don't necessarily have a lot of money. They don't have enough volume, and you're going to have 1,000 customers that give you like pennies on the, you know, on each month. And I would be very concerned about that. I mean, you'd much rather have 50 customers paying you $50 a month than 1,000 customers or 2,000 customers, each of whom you're only getting, you know, maybe $3, $4, or $5 a month because they're only shipping out one or two things. That would be an area of big concern to me.
I have concern. I think this could work, but I think it needs a specific couple things to fall into place. Number one, that percentage should not be small. You need to make a substantial amount on each package. And that's where I was saying, if you can nail it down that they really just want the multi-channel, you don't even need to talk about discounts. There's a company right now, and I forget if they're called Ship or Ship It or something like that. They are making all their money because they get these massive volume discounts, and they will take your stuff and ship it for you, but they just charge you the rack rate, right? The list price for the UPS and stuff, and they take the entire float in between that. And that can be several dollars per shipment. And that's the kind of revenue you're going to need, especially if you're planning on, you're going after small e-commerce sites. So what do they ship? 10 things a month? 30, 40, 50 things a month? I mean, we're not talking about thousands a month, or else they get the volume discount. So if someone's only shipping 20 things a month and you're making 20 cents per, then you're making $4 a month off your customer. You're done. You're never going to be able to acquire customers for less than that. So, you know, if you are going to try to go after this model, I'm talking $1, $1.50 per shipment that you need to make. And so then those 20 shipments actually makes you $20 to $30 a month. And if they stick around, then you do have some kind of lifetime value there. I like the idea of trying to go around the monthly subscription model that the other guys are doing. However, you're a bootstrapper, and that makes it a lot harder, because the clearest path to revenue and profitability for you is to have recurring revenue. And so to me, this can be something to try out. But in the first month or two, if you have people signing up and their volume is really low and you're not making enough money, I have seen a number of companies, including Shopify. When Shopify first launched, all it was a cut. It was a percentage. There was no monthly fee. Within 6 months, they had a $20 monthly fee. And now if you look at them, that's where their monthly fees are pretty substantial, to be honest, based on volume. And the reason they did that is because that's the way you grow, and that's the way you actually build a profitable business, is having these monthly fees. For better or worse, I know that, you know, some customers may not like them, but the customers that do and the customers that actually are willing to pay it are going to be the best customers. Those are the ones that you really want to get in and use the product. So I'm a little concerned about it. The ones that I know that take that percentage are typically funded companies, and they can outlast. And if you go back and watch Jason Cohen's talk from MicroConf 2013, he talks about the ideal bootstrap business, and he says, don't build a business where you're taking a small percentage off of each transaction, because you're probably not going to get to the level of volume. And so that's what I'm saying. If you do take a percentage, it needs to be a large one.
His third question is, what do you think is the best approach to market this type of product? I thought of just starting out with 1 to 2 customers and have them run with it for some time. I can also use my e-commerce business for testing.
That's 2 different questions, right? One is, how do you market this? And 2 is like, how do you, you're talking about doing customer development. For customer development, I would hope that by this point that you have 5 or 10 people lined up that are really chomping at the bit to use it. If you don't, please stop writing code and please go find these people, whether it's through your network, which is probably where I'd start, whether it's through forums, whether it's through writing into Tropical MBA podcasts, whether it's, you know, I don't want to get Dan and Ian sent a bunch of email, but I mean, that's the, it's that type of audience where there's going to be people who can at least tell you if they need it or not, right? It's going to be an easy discussion when you talk to 30, 40 of e-commerce vendors and they all say, hey, this is fantastic. Heck yes, build this and this is what I need. Or they all say, this isn't really solving my problem. And that latter response is going to be really disappointing to hear, but it's better than continuing down a path that may not yield you anything in the end.
Right. And those discussions are going to help you formulate what the best approach to market the product is, because they're going to tell you where they would have searched for it or where they've already searched for it and what sorts of things that they've looked at and what they've found lacking. I mean, just talking to customers and asking them bluntly, what else have you tried or what else have you used to solve this problem that has not worked? You get that answer back from people and they will tell you not only what they've tried, but why it didn't work for them. And that can guide you to figure out how your product needs to, you know, be positioned in terms of the negative marketing effects to say, this is not how we work. This is, we do this other thing over here. And, you know, you tell that to people up front because chances are really good that other people have encountered that same problem and they've tried whatever the other solution was. It didn't work for them. And the reasons are the same. And you can leverage that to your advantage with your own application.
Yeah. I mean, and I think the answer, the first part, which is what is the best approach to market this type of product? It's every marketing approach that I would use for any SaaS app, because that's essentially what this is. There's SEO, there's content marketing, there's paid acquisition there. You know, I mean, it's just, it's all the stuff that I would use. There's no best approach. It's you have to try a bunch of stuff, figure out what works, and double down on that.
And his last question is, my other concern is that the competition. These guys are all pretty big with deep pockets and provide many more features in a shorter period of time. I would argue that that's probably not true. The fact that they're bigger means that they're probably going to ignore you. And even if you come out with some great feature, they're probably just, they're not, even if they do see it, they're probably just not going to bother implementing it because it's just going to take so much time to implement it in their environment because of corporate red tape. If they are that big, they will largely ignore you until you start stealing enough business in any given market where they have sales reps, and they will notice at that point. But I remember talking to a VP of marketing of several companies that had been purchased under his watch, and he basically said flat out, he's like, you know, large companies will not notice you until multiple sales reps have their deals stolen from them and they tell their manager in the same quarter, because there's relatively high turnover there and you just will not get noticed. I would not worry about that.
I think the only thing you need to figure out is, how are we going to answer the question when someone says, how is your product different than big competitor, right? You need to be able to answer that in one sentence very quickly and not need paragraphs of like, well, we have these other features and we have blah, blah, blah. It's like, what is the value prop? You can say, well, they only do one shipper and we do all 5. Or they don't give you bulk discounts even if you're a small vendor. Like, those are the 2 things that you've mentioned that are to pique my interest the most. So if they do both of those things, then, you know, I don't know what your competitive advantage is. And if they don't do those things, but those things aren't important to potential customers, then you're going to have a real struggle. But in terms of big competitors, I would not even worry about them at this point, especially if you're building something that is different enough that, you know, small businesses will take notice.
So, Paul, thanks for the question. And we have a second Paul for our last question. He says, hey, guys, I started listening to the show a couple of months ago, and it's really changed how I think about my startup. Wanted to say thanks to both of you for such an awesome podcast. My question is this. I sell downloadable shrink wrap software. Analytics tools like Kissmetrics make it possible to see that Joe visited my website, browsed some pages, subscribed to a mailing list, and downloaded the software. But then there's a disconnect. Joe works for a big company, and his company only buys software from approved vendors, so the person who enters their credit card to buy the software usually isn't Joe. They may even work for a different company. From an analytics point of view, are there ways to know that it was Joe who eventually bought a license, even though someone else actually paid for it? How can I test ways to increase the chance that Joe will buy a license if I can't tell whether Joe did buy a license? Thanks. All the best.
Well, the first thing is you can't. I mean, there's no way to do it for sure. But the first thing I would do is start doing email domain matchups. I know you said it could be from a separate company. My guess is that's less of the time. So if you can start matching up, you know, the domain name of the email address across everything, right? Across your marketing funnel, your trials, your downloads, your paid, your customers, and just match those up, then it can at least give you some insight that there were multiple people from the same company looking at and buying. We've done this. I've done this with .NET Invoice because we see similar stuff where multiple people from the same company evaluate and then a different person buys. So that's a decent way to do it. The other way I would do is when someone buys a license, I would either have a question right there when they buy it, or I would have email follow-up that basically says, how did you hear about this? Can you please let us know if you're buying this on, are you buying this on behalf of someone else? How about that question on the purchase page, and ask if they'll enter a name or enter an email or enter a company name. Just try to get a data point there, but that's the only way.
I mean, in terms of something like Kissmetrics, you've got all the data down to the point that where they downloaded the software. What you don't have is the person who came in and actually made the purchase. And you should be able to basically hand some of that information off to a VA or something like that to have them basically take a look at that very last stage in the funnel where there's a purchase being made. The other thing you could do is you could also try and match it up on the licensing itself. So when you send them a license, ask them to register the software. And as part of the registration for the software, ask them for their email address. And you may be able to open up a browser or something like that and get their cookie information that way. But obviously, that's not going to work if they're installing it on a server and they downloaded it from their desktop. So there's some issues there. But you may very well be able to get them to enter in their own personal email address there and use that as essentially a mechanism for feeding some of that information in. It's not foolproof. It's probably the best you can do. But I think that there's, you know, in general, I think that this entire problem is pretty hard to solve.
If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.